Clerk, will you roll call?
All right, Major Dickerson.
Lori Lebowski, Clark County Community Planning.
Steve Colby, Clark County Public Works Transportation.
Juan Hardy, Bridger Avenue.
First and Moss, first and.
Sean Massey, Tassau.
Andy Sepulveda, Clark County.
Darrell Overton, Green Plains.
David Jardine, Concurrency.
Right, thank you. Just a little note that this meeting will be recorded and placed on the county's website. I think we've got that all scored away, so they are actually going on the website now. We do have on our agenda to welcome Terry Wallum, but he does not appear to be here yet, so we'll take that opportunity when and if he arrives. Also, if you have cell phones, if you can put them on vibrator off, we'd appreciate it. For those who have had a chance, next item on the agenda is to review and adopt the minutes, so I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstained? Great, thank you. Greg, review upcoming events.
Absolutely. We have a very full agenda. I'll move quickly on this. These are essentially work sessions or hearings through the month of May. We have a Board of County Commissioners work session on the Clark County Stormwater Manual and Municipal Code update. That's on Wednesday, May 14th, 11:15 in the morning. Board of County Commissioners hearing, two that are noted there, two separate hearings, population and employment allocation, and then second, marijuana-related facilities. Those hearings do start on Tuesday, May 27th at 10 a.m. And then lastly, another work session following day on the Clean Water Commission annual report presentation, Wednesday, May 28th, 10:30 a.m. For the Planning Commission, there's a work session on the Northeast 10th Avenue Clark Regional Wastewater District, Washougal UGA Removal and Arterial Atlas 5th Plain Creek Area, Thursday, May 1st. Whoa, today. Today, if you're going to that, tonight, 5:30 p.m. And then in 2 weeks, Planning Commission hearing, open space and timberland applications. Northeast 10th Avenue, Clark Regional Wastewater District, and Washougal UGA Removal, Thursday, May 15th, 6:30 p.m.
And one addition to that will be tentatively scheduled for June 4th, Wednesday at 10 o'clock a.m. will be Deeb's annual report to the Board of County Commissioners. We had to postpone that because of scheduling conflicts with the board from this month to next month. So that's when we'll be doing that, which allows us a little more time to work on our priorities list for this year and the coming year, which is next on our agenda. But at this time, I'd like to defer discussion of that until after the presentations today, as it might take a little bit longer than what we have time for within our first 15 minutes here. So we'll go ahead without any objections. We'll go ahead and delay that until after the stormwater ordinance update near the end of our meeting today. Any correspondences? It doesn't appear that there are.
I don't think we had any.
Okay. And are there any Deeb member announcements that's here today? Okay, seeing none. We'll go ahead and move right along then to the next item on our agenda is the concurrency update and Q&A with Lori.
Hey there. As I mentioned, I'm Lori Lebowski with Community Planning. And I want to also introduce Steve Schulte and Public Works. He also works with me on this project as well as behind me, David Jardine in Development Review Engineering, and Gary Albrecht also in Community Planning. So as you can see, we're talking today about concurrency and the capital facilities plan project that we've been working on. It involves simplifying and streamlining our concurrency code and our capital facilities plan. We will be addressing TIF at a later time. However, the TIF rates, they will decrease when we do adopt a revised CFP later this year. But before I go any further, feel free to interrupt me, and if you have questions, we're just here to discuss what the proposal is. Also want to make sure that you have the information in front of you. I emailed to Greg and Rosie the proposed code changes. Make sure you have that.
Should be in your packet.
Yeah. And then also, your packet today on the bottom page, there's the revised CFP. Just make sure that you have that. We'll get to those documents later.
Sorry to interrupt you right out of the gate. Is this revised CFP based on the changes here and as a result of all the changes that are taking place?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah, I'm going to need an engineer. Anyway, that's basically what we're covering today, is the concurrency program updates and the CFP. These are guiding principles for concurrency. You can see we wanted a predictable program, as I mentioned, a simpler and streamlined process. For us, as well as the applicants, increased awareness of locations. One thing that we are getting into more is automating the monitoring of congestion. There's some projects we're working on with in collaboration with the state, specifically on signals and signal monitoring. These are the key elements of our updated concurrency and assumptions that go along with that update. At the first point there, we based our revision of the CFP based on the Office of Finance Management, their median projection of 1.12% population growth each year. That was a population growth projection that the Board of County Commissioners adopted recently. As you may or may not know, our capital facilities plan is a 20-year planning horizon as required under statewide growth management. The major change that we're making to concurrency is that we're going from a standard of travel speeds and travel times on corridors, and we're going to a volume measurement or a volume to capacity ratio. And with that change to focusing on capacity, typically when you focus on volume and capacity, it's more of a measurement of length. We have a concern as far as intersections. We want to make sure that the safety and capacity is preserved at intersections. So we have language in our code that talks about monitoring intersections and ensuring that they're operating safely and an acceptable level of service.
Question. So the new measuring standard of the roadway volume?
Yes.
That's commonly accepted in the industry standards, so to speak, among other agencies, or is this a new thing for us here?
Other agencies use that standard. I believe the city of Vancouver uses that standard. ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation, uses that standard.
Next question.
One thing that standard couples up is annually RTC puts out a congestion monitoring report. And they report congestion in the county based on that EC ratio. So we'll be linked up with the RTC data when it comes out.
For the non-engineer, is there a rough equivalency that would give somebody an understanding of what the 90% volume to capacity to the current standard? Is this a lowering of the standard? Is this an increase in the standard?
I don't think we want to even speculate on that. It's a completely different measurement tool. Certain things we do are more restrictive. For example, the current system, we measure both travel times, both directions of travel average. The new system, we're taking the worst direction of travel, the most congested, and calling down the volume for the other way. So on that front, we're not averaging, we're taking the worst. The other thing is we're looking at the lengths of segments between intersections. Was the old system more likely affected dwelling time at the intersections? So we're measuring segments now instead of intersections. So it's a very different measurement approach. But again, it does match up with RTC and other jurisdictions. And it's a simpler metric. It's hard for folks to envision what 6.5 minute travel speed through the Santa Creek Avenue corridor means. It's a little bit easier to say, well, that roadway's running at 90% of capacity.
As an example, if you don't mind, I'll move to the next slide. Just to kind of, I think it illustrates the volumes and capacity range that we're talking about. Example we have is 78th Street east of Highway 99. Capacity is 7,000 vehicles. Existing traffic is 2,200. Plus the permitted traffic, which is all the development that we've approved, an additional 1,300. And the volume is 3,500 in the peak hour. And as you can see in this example, then it's at 50% of capacity, and therefore it's not in concurrency failure. So as Steve's saying, I think it's a simpler, more understandable way to approach.
Three simple questions. Again, for the engineers, for you guys, it all is, but it, for me, it's not. I know what 6.5 minutes looks like. I don't know what capacity is.
Well, in this example, the capacity is 7,000 in peak hour.
And that's and determined how?
Well, based on the design of the road, we assume a capacity for that road.
Okay.
And then when you come in and submit a traffic study, you'll give us that information. Some of that information comes from RTC. So we have an idea of what's out there right now as far as the traffic based on the volumes, what's been studied, in addition to what we call the in-process traffic or what's been approved, what developments have been.
I get everything below that.
So maybe think of it as a pipe.
Right.
So you're looking at the roadways now as a pipe, and is it a 2-inch pipe, is it an 8-inch pipe? And it's going to change by the number of lanes, the size of the lanes, the shoulders. There's a lot of factors that go into figuring out the capacity. But you can basically take the cross-section and certain factors, and there's a set method for figuring out what the capacity is of that, kind of like the same way you figure out how much water can flow through a certain size pipe. So they're looking at that snapshot, what's the capacity, and how many trips are actually going there now. So you're going to have it. Does that make sense?
And each classification of roadway has its own design capacity.
Design capacity has to, doesn't it correlate somehow to, because we were working level service, A through F or whatever. Is design capacity somewhere, is it what, level service C, is it in the middle, or is it when you're at 100% capacity? Does that mean,
I think that's similar. In our arterial atlas, which is our plan for roads, as Eric mentioned, there's so many lanes for 78th Street, and there's a rule of thumb as far as how many vehicles are per lane mile, and that's where we come up with the capacity. But it is similar where you have the A through F.
Kind of the way I look at it, when you get above 100% capacity, you get progressive backups. So each minute there seems to be traffic backing up, you can't get through. like a two-lane collector. Occasionally, if you have an intersection, someone's going to stop to turn left and they back the traffic up. So okay. We start seeing progressive backups. That's when we're at about a 1.0. Now, a good example, I believe a two-lane collector built out to county standards, 4-foot lanes, is going to have about 800 vehicles per hour per lane. So if that northbound direction has 300 vehicles, and it's got a capacity of 800, that's 3/8 of 1 would be the percent.
It's even 100 vehicles for those minutes.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Another question. Going back before the time travel model we currently have, how does this relate to the prior system that was in place, the original emergency system that was in place?
The original system looked at delay time at individual intersections. And the system we're on now, today, is looking at travel speeds and travel time through corridors. But most of the delay time in those corridors is focused at the intersections. Now we're looking at corridors, but we're looking at the links or the segments between intersections. So it's a different measure. But I think it's also important, we have intersection mobility standards, I call them safety net standards, not to confuse those with safety standards, but we have kind of bare minimum mobility standards at intersections that we have in the current code and we're proposing to put in the future code. Like a 180 seconds of maximum delay on individual movements and signalized intersections. Those kind of standards we're carrying over. So if there is a mobility problem at an individual intersection, we will look at that problem. That can trigger a concurrency layer.
Does this make it easier for the county? Is there a modeler that the county is going to be using so it's on the same system? Basically, if you were traveling today, you're going to be dumping the model. The county is managing the model. So the
it's going to be easier to work with RTC in a long-term modeling. If we change zoning, land use, we can look at changes. If it's a simpler metric, from staff's perspective, it's easier to understand. And I think it's easier to understand for the community for lane too.
But the county will control the model and that's what I want to understand.
Yes, the county concurrency engineer. County will maintain a model to track current development in process, traffic, growth rates, all of that. Current existing conditions, future conditions. I get to control that and monitor that. And of course, and she's not here yet, but there's as part of the code change, there's an annual reporting that gets done to the board on this stuff here. So, and that would be me or my office.
Steve, you kind of half answered my question I was going to ask. But the additional protective level of service standard for individual intersections, you said there's still some of those things we're going to maintain in our code. But does that mean that we're making it that much, that this is going to be a simpler process, or is it adding another layer? I guess what I'm concerned with is if we're still looking at the protective level of service stuff we have in the code, does that mean we're going to look at level service intersections plus the capacity correlation on the corridors, or is this additional protective LOS significantly different than what we're doing now at the intersections?
Actually, the level of service standards at the intersections is going to remain unchanged. What's going to happen with this new model is instead of worrying about a Salmon Creek corridor, right? Travel speeds through the corridor are 13 miles an hour currently. You know, that's the threshold where we say you can't go below. So developments, as they come in and we take a look at them and we see, oh no, you're getting within a 13 mile an hour shut down development in the area. That is typically an unknown to a developer. It's kind of, well, gosh, we would have had to have gone out and run the speed test and look at all the in process, all of that kind of stuff. What this will do
ultimately is at the beginning of each year on this annual reporting basis is we will look at the volumes, the existing volumes on the roadway, compare them to the capacity that's been allowed, and see where the corridor is basically for the year. That says, well, we're at 60% of capacity, corridors open, or segments are open along this corridor and open for development. And typically what you see when you do something like that is it takes a long time to get enough volume or enough development that has that kind of volume on that roadway to shut the roadway down at a 0.9 or ask for mitigation at 0.9 VC ratio. So it's not an extra level of analysis. A lot of the traffic studies already include the trips that they're sending across the corridors or into the corridors. So it's just now they're giving me something that I physically take out. I put that number over here on this corridor and I monitor that over the course of the year.
So if there was a failing movement under the old way, you guys would do it, but just barely over failing. But the rest of the roadway had plenty of capacity. Under this new method, is it going to be less likely that there'll be mitigation of that failing movement? Just one small movement, say it's a right turn lane or a left turn lane or something like that at an intersection. Under the old one, it would have been triggered, where there'd be lane improvements, maybe not a signal. Under the new one, would it still likely be triggered?
Well, I'll give you my rendition. We have three tools now, previously, and we'll have three in the future. On a completely different topic than we're talking about this afternoon, on our safety authorities from ASHTO, from WDOT, from NGCD, which have for safety. Those aren't changing. Those are national standards we've adopted. We have no discretion on those. Those are not changing. And I think, frankly, we'll see more safety failures in the future than we have in the past. Then we're retaining our mobility standards at intersections, like that 180. It's
240
seconds of maximum delay at a signalized intersection individually. We're retaining those as our bare bones mobility standards at intersections. So what's changing right now on this third front is right now we have corridor travel times, travel speeds to corridors. Those are minutes and seconds. And we're going to VC ratios. Corridors. That's where the change is.
Seems like it's nailing.
And I can't speculate if one is more demanding than the other.
Really can't.
So we're not going to see differences on the way we do traffic studies for intersections. It's going to be exactly the same.
Correct.
Okay.
Would it look difficult to run a model that would tell you what might happen at that? I went into 9 East 78th Street. That particular example that you're using, here's the old method, here's the new method, here's the old method. Well, okay, you did the capacity version of it here.
Right.
I guess we could. What we have done, and this maybe gets to the bottom line, is we put in the new growth rate, 1.12%. It's lower than the previous growth rate from 2007. And we had a much smaller capital facilities need than we did back in 2007. So we can downsize our capital facilities plan pretty dramatically. And there's many, many fewer failures.
It's based on growth rate.
Well, either based on kind of the measurement that you were discussing or the reduction in growth rate. Probably one of those two factors is bringing the number of needed capital projects down dramatically.
Would that be the one what really is triggering? What's the controlling variable? And what's the actual impact of this new methodology? I guess here's one moment. I understand the simplicity part, that's good. But if it has other impacts, maybe the more complicated model is actually better for planning purposes and development. I don't know the answer to that question.
what, and probably Dean should hear this complete presentation, where we ended up with the board, where they were happy with the BC ratio, after that, they were happy with the size of the downsized CFP fuel projects. They're happy with the 20-year cost of the CFP. It came down dramatically. So the board seems to be happy with what staff's come up with. And I'll leave that with Dean for now.
Can you say other impacts you have?
Well, just this one, just the CFP project. If I'm a commissioner, I want less demands on my budget also. But maybe that's not best for the community at large and the development community in particular.
I think tangibly, just if I can maybe give an example, I think it sounds like a really good thing going forward. It's simpler. I love the idea of modeling and county controlling that. I think the unintended consequence, I guess, for measuring from the old system to the new system, if you have one layer of intersection, for example, that's failing out of the old system, is that averaged throughout that segment? Now, the new system, you now suddenly need to address that mitigation for that segment. That would be one example. And maybe not hitting the nail on the head, but would there be more requirements in that scenario?
In an element, capital facilities plan element, what Lori's going to talk about later is we have a much more fluid and adaptable CFP level. So the way we're setting it up is if we see a failure out there, getting close, maybe we're 80%, we see 90, we have some pots of money that we can move toward that particular location. The CFP is going to be flexible with those pots of money, so we can dedicate some dollars there to this particular node or intersection or link, and then at that point it can go in a six-year TIF and be dedicated to that improvement. So what the county's doing, we're planning to come in with county funds and do more mitigation than historically we've done with county funds. And because we're going to be watching things closer, we're going to be more to know about where those future points of failure are.
Well, I'll let Lori finish your presentation.
Okay. And maybe as we go further, maybe we'll answer some of your questions. So other elements of the update to concurrency include going from a one-hour measurement of peak traffic to a two-hour. We are going to further in engineering and planning, investigate monitoring corridors and their level of service and finding some way to color code that or something of that sort. Once roadways and intersections are built out to the arterial atlas standards, they will not be further tested for concurrency. They'll be exempt. However, as Steve mentioned, we will follow safety standards and we have fast toe and that sort of thing in terms of safety that we have to address. And then as I mentioned previously, we are moving towards automation of traffic counting and monitoring. Some of that's with some of the work that Rob Klug is doing with SIGMO and signal monitoring, which potentially could inform concurrency. I'm going to move on to CFP. We talked about it a little bit. Our projected capital funding in terms of revenue is we're estimating a range of revenue between $510 to $540 million. We see a budget shortfall, and per the state standards, we have to adopt the fiscally constrained capital facilities plan. And what I want to do next is talk about the list of projects on the capital facilities plan draft CFP. So we'll get your list out. I'll just continue different categories. Again, as I mentioned previously, this CFP is based on OSM medium population projections. The projects on this list are TIF creditable as long as they are regionally significant. And we define regionally significant as whether they're a collector or material. So the first group you see here are committed. And these are the projects that are in the six-year TIF. They're either fully funded or partially funded. These are set in stone, this first group. The second group, these are the concurrency-driven projects based on that OSM projection. And we worked with RTC in looking at links and intersections where there are issues in terms of concurrency, in terms of this new VOC ratio or standard that we've been talking about. I just want to draw your attention to one of the lines under number two, under concurrency driven urban arterial intersections. As the name implies, it's not allocated to any specific location, and it is TIF eligible. Just going to what Steve said earlier about concerns with intersections and want to have the flexibility that if there's a location that comes up and if there's an issue there in terms of capacity and the safety, we want to have flexibility in terms of our funding to be able to move money, funding over to fix an intersection where there may be an issue.
Is this new? Because I like the idea a lot. Is it something that we've had for a while, or?
We've
had, back in the 2007 CFP, we had a lot of money. Believe it or not, there's not much we can depend on. It was split into an intersection funnel money and a roadway segment or lane funnel money. But there simply hasn't been much demand on it. But if you look at an annual amount to consume it all in 20 years, we're way underrunning that spending level. But again, this is this pot of money that's unallocated now that over time, staff will develop criteria. So we'll know what kind of facility can qualify for the money. Certainly a local access road that has no regional significance to that is 10 homeowners probably would not qualify. But a major intersection upgrade would, but we'll allocate these out over time to various improvements as they begin their first go here.
So, for example, an offset intersection of regional significance that got triggered by a specific project, and then that developer is not on the TIF program now, so it's not creditable. So they're actually having to put forward, you know, funds towards that intersection that may be eligible to fit into this category where they can do the improvements and become creditable. Is that kind of okay? And I don't know that people knew about that, and maybe that's why it's underutilized. It's a good idea. I mean, that's something we've kind of discuss on individual projects before.
Just moving on, the third category of projects are new projects are regional and partnership projects. Some of these are ones that we've had on the list in cooperation with WashDOT, for example. So we wanted that in category for those types of projects. And then finally, the last category is the TIF ongoing programs. It's not a discrete project that ends. Good example is road preservation. Every year we do overlays and that sort of thing.
Question on that?
Yep.
Going back, get these little footnotes here. I see one is on the 15,000. And
right.
Preference is cost of contaminated doesn't include the bridge.
That's correct. That's just only for the bridge.
That's that extension north of 16, like the kind of arcs to the west.
West, yeah.
Yeah.
So you think you can switch there?
It's pretty wet up there. It's a critical habitat.
What was that?
Roman numeral 4, second from the bottom, urban development growth program. This is another pot of money that's not allocated. Whereas the previous one under Roman numeral 2 was aimed at large intersections, this one is more of a, if we're looking to help job creation, there may be some roads we can build, job access for new jobs. So this would be more on a local area scale than a regional benefiting kind of intersection. But again, there's 1.25 million each year that the county could use to fund those kinds, practically fund those improvement projects to help job creation. That's the key word on that one, job creation.
Is there a minimum criteria on that?
Well, we're going to have to set some up. We will be. Thanks.
Very beautiful. So just a recap of the CFP 2007 to cost to complete, that's new amount that we have on this list that we just went over. And as I previously mentioned, that's the 510 to 540, that's the estimated range of revenue that we're looking at.
One of the things we did was in 07, the CFP was a with inflation CFP, so inflation was embedded in those cost numbers. We stripped it out. So that $952 million in 07 is equivalent to $760 million in 2014. And the CFP you just were looking at had a bottom line of $532 million in cost of $14. So we're comparing an apple to an apple. So if you're curious just how much, what percentage did the dollar cost reduce from 07 to 14 is 532 divided by 760. That's the reduction we saw in CFP cost. So if you wanted to know roughly what tips go down, it would be that same percentage rate. But again, it's going to vary based on which district you're in and things like that.
30%.
That was one of the goals, was to look hard for cost savings. It's highly uncertain what 20-year revenue is going to be. It's hard to solve things.
Yes. Yeah, we refined this table recently. The handout looks like just the CMP cost of completion.
Right,
so
that was a different number. And
so what's the right one?
532.
So we should cross that out.
Yeah, that was from an older version of the table.
532.5. Okay.
Were there any other questions?
Yes. Mike and I were talking. Does this project being a TIF waiver program impact how do you?
I think that's a separate issue from what we're discussing. It's a separate policy question.
If you calculate the proportionate share that developers should pay per TIF, it maybe is a third, 33%, something like that. But because of all the reductions we had in the traffic impact program, the actual revenues in are well less than 10%. There's tax offset factors, there's business enhancement factors, there's pass-by factors. So historically, the county really hasn't got that much revenue in their capital program. So, fee waiver has hurt our funding ability, but not
as big a way as Vancouver would be making. I think our revenues now, well, a couple of years ago, kind of went a lot up for less than a million a year.
I guess just again, from my perspective, I just want to make sure that there isn't a cost going on.
Yeah, I think this is a separate issue.
Just a confirmation that number one, committed 6-year GIP first column, that those are committed to orders.
Yes.
The rest of this is forecasted based on.
Based on the OSM population.
Using a model that's proposed.
Yes.
So what happens? That's one of my questions. What happens if the number is wrong? How often do you review this? In other words, if we get more population growth than anticipated, because that's one of the drivers that's driving this down, right?
Right, that is one of the drivers that's driving it down.
So for those of us that are afraid that that's a low population number potentially, who bears the costs when, you know, if it's not on our capital facilities project, I think I know the answer, but if it's not on our capital facilities project, we've gone over 2% growth and some of the roads are failing.
Right. Well, I guess I would say, number one, this isn't set in stone, and that's why we do comp plan updates every so that we do periodically because
right,
things happen and they do change. Also, the capital facilities plan is adopted with a budget and or. For example, this is going to be adopted with a supplemental budget.
Right.
So there's flexibility in terms of when the CFP is adopted to where we can make some adjustments.
I guess that was one of my questions. I know you do the budget. Is that something you'd be looking at on a yearly basis? Actually, what's happening on the ground in terms of the population?
Not sure we'll be done yearly. I would see certainly with the comp plan update that's underway now, at least 16 or 17.
16.
This very well could be redone as a part of that application.
Right. That's an excellent point, is that as far as process, this will be adopted with supplemental budget in November of this year. However, given our comp plan update, this could be changed a little bit and adopted with the comp plan update so that it's compatible with what's developed.
Lori, thank you. It looks like you have some follow-up information on here that you plan on coming back to us on June 5th.
Yes. Well, let me. I know you're short on time, but.
Oh no, we actually have plenty of time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got some more slides.
Oh.
Not
close.
A whole lot more.
Okay.
This is a map of the 2007 capital facilities plan. Red and blue, those are all the projects. The blue, and again, this is, I'm sure, really clear to see, but the blue lines are the projects that are completed or funded.
I can see it. It's fun.
Yeah, I can see it. Would it help if the lights were out?
Those are big ticket items. Those are the $20-25 million.
items. And we're not sure which of those is going to come first. It very well could be pad and grade.
That's an interchange?
I'm saying we'll need to go to grade separation.
Oh, grades.
Right.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Drive through now, back through there in the AM or the PM.
Yeah.
Pretty good. So there'll be some, there's some uncertainty about when those docks will need to go to grade separation, and that's a big money to do that. The extent to which the state will have dollars to fund their share of those grade separation projects is unknown.
Yeah, that's a good question. Are there any other questions about this map? Okay, I'm going to move on to, this is the map of mapping the projects under our proposal. The green are is the new project. Looks like just one project on San Creek Avenue. And that was one that when RTC did the modeling under the new DOC standard, but that kind of popped out. Brown, those are the projects that fell off the CFP under the new standard and the new OFM projection. And then blue, again, those are projects that are funded or constructed or will be constructed in the near term.
What is green being?
It's a new project.
And what kind of funding certainty does it have?
Well, this is CFP, so it's not like the TIF, where the TIF you have the funding identified. If this is just a big picture long term. Right.
Hypothetically, you know, the Legler Ferries is going to be that just gets added.
If it shows up in terms of the model for the standard, yes. Okay, I'm going to move on. Next step. We're going to come back to you on June 5th just to kind of finalize what we're doing. We were going to build in some review time for me. Here are the hearing dates. We're going to Planning Commission for a work session on June 5th. So we're going to come back to you guys on June 5th, and then that evening we'll just stay in this room and have a work session with the Planning Commission. And then the hearing will be with Planning Commission will be July 17th. And then board hearing is August 19th. With the board hearing, we will discuss both the CFP and concurrency. The code changes will be adopted on the 19th. However, the process is slightly different for the CFP. It's part of the budget adoption process. So when the county adopts a supplemental budget November 4th, this new CFP will be adopted at the same time and will become effective at the same time. That's all I have. If you have any other questions.
I think that was great, Lori. Thank you very much. as far as our next steps as a board, the Planning Commission has indicated that they'd like to have any comments or feelings about something in advance of their meeting. Since we're going to have... Since our next presentation on this from staff is going to be on the same date, I think we need to provide the Planning Commission something in advance of that, a recommendation or at least something to let them know that we've reviewed this. The only hesitancy might be in review of the proposed code changes, which we haven't had an opportunity to review, and might suggest that whatever we agree on tonight today, that we take time in advance of June 5th to review the code, and if there are any questions or concerns that come up as part of that, that we can either go ahead and email those out or address them at the next board meeting or our next meeting, and then that can be relayed directly on to the Planning Commission that night. But I think that nuts and bolts of everything here, aside from some minor tweaks or changes, are have been presented before us. So from an action on DEEP's standpoint, I would entertain a motion, anything from, you know, I'll let the board decide.
Can I just add something else?
Sure.
So, I mean, obviously the more time Planning Commission has, the better. We did give you the proposed code changes at this time, so you have that. I guess I would just advocate for, you know, making sure we have time to get that information to Planning Commission, because right now what we want to do is the code changes that we have now and the CFP we have now, that's what I'm going to present to Planning Commission.
Gotcha.
Unless you want something.
Gotcha. So any other comments from us we need to be done, say, within the next week or so, so that they could be incorporated in the next 2 weeks?
Right.
May 16th would be, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. But I do believe we need to have something from the go to the Planning Commission regarding this.
So, a suggestion.
Yes.
On timing.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the concept, and from what I've heard on the concept, I agree with the approach you're taking. I actually don't see a lot of significant changes to the way we do business, except that the TIF fee could go down based on projects falling off. Is that correct? I mean, the impact of the development community. There's a lot of code language in here, which is some details, which we probably have not looked at as a group yet. Could we make a motion that we... we're in general agreement with the approach that they're using, and then before the commissioner hearing, if we have additional comments on the specific language, we bring that out then, because Planning Commission is probably not going to be as interested in these minute details in this code mm-hmm. language. It might be wordsmithing. So I guess I would, if you guys would agree, make a motion to support the concept, and that can go to Planning Commission now, and then we hold off the detail wordsmithing for the commissioner hearing.
Have you made your motion yet?
No, I'm bringing it up as a suggestion,
okay.
And it's more of a discussion.
Okay.
What do you guys think of that?
If we want to do anything as far as code, I agree with Jamie that we get, you know, we take 2 weeks maximum to provide any comments back after that.
Yeah.
Unless you show up at the mm-hmm. at the Planning Commission. Is that a work session? I'm sorry. It's a work session.
Right.
Unless you show up at the work session, that our comments may not have an opportunity to be incorporated into any of their work or into the changes, the code changes. So, but if that works out.
This is not my area of expertise. So really, what I'm taking away from this is the dollars allocated to the CFP. Beyond that, I don't know what the impact's going to be. I would suggest that the level of service, as it used to be measured, is going to be. I'm not saying those are bad things. Those are probably helpful things as far as job growth and development. But I'm not sure what we're going to recommend. We're going to recommend that we support the change in the measuring metrics.
Yeah, the approach that has been basically from this presentation, the concept that they're using to change it from the time delay to a capacity, that we were supportive of that change. I think it simplifies it. I really like, just a few highlights in my mind, I really like that color-coded model that you guys are talking about using. I think that will, it's easier to follow. You can, it's like you look at like Google Map, and you would have red and green and yellow, so you can see as things start approaching. And instead of, like, when we're doing a feasibility study, we're right now, a lot of times, we don't know where to go. We're talking to a traffic engineer. We're going off of the last project we know of and where we knew there were problems, and we're spinning off of that. Being able to pull up a map and see colors, yeah, that's a great idea.
This right here.
Well,
That's
a capital facility. I'm talking about a bullet.
The color-coded map would be...
None of those, yes.
No, it would be for a certain area. Red, yellow, green would mean how close they are to capacity, mm-hmm. volume to capacity yeah. ratio. So say it's at a 30%, it'd be green. If it's at 60%, it's at in yellow, and if it's at 80%, it's in red.
So for those two reasons, simplicity, mm-hmm. yeah, clarity, yeah. I think we could support it. Okay. Yeah, at least I'll just speak for myself. Yeah.
And I think that being able to align with RTC's model and more readily is a good step too, to okay. use those.
Well, if there's any other discussion, I'll entertain a motion.
Well, I will move to that DEEB supports the concepts outlined in the presentation today on changing the, you guys can wordsmith it exactly how you want to say it, but basically what you've said today about changing it from a level of or time delay to a capacity analysis. And if you have any suggestions on how you think the motion should read, I'd like to hear those as well.
I was just going to say support the changes to the county's transportation concurrency program and capital facilities plan. Those are two topics.
Did you get that out?
Transportation
concurrency
program
yeah.
and capital facilities plan.
Sounds good.
Why do you, why do you support that area?
Why do I support it? From the stuff that was outlined today. More predictability, simpler, easier to follow. The TIF has potential to go down, so projects are dropping off based on this new analysis.
Yeah.
That's the reason why I support it.
Very good.
Okay, very good. Any other discussion?
I think the discussion is if we have comments on the code language that it should get sent to staff by May 16th.
Yes.
So they can include that in the session.
Okay. We'll have that as an amendment. We'll have a second on the amendment.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. We'll vote on the amendment first. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Abstentions? Very good. Then back to the original motion. Any further discussion on that? None seen. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Abstentions? Very good. Lori, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lori.
Appreciate it. Steve, thank you. David, thank you. Before we go any further, I would like to welcome Terry Wallum to our board. Terry, thank you for coming.
Yep.
We'll get to know you here as we go along. Glad you could make it. Sorry you couldn't make it last month.
And, oh, yeah. Yep.
We're grateful in that regard. I'd like to also note the presence of Mr. Benton with Environmental Services here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Next item on the docket is going to be the stormwater update. And I guess that's Ron and Rob.
Yep.
R&R. And it looks like we're on time too, so.
Yeah, so Ron Merida with Environmental Services and Water Program. I have Ron Swanson, our NPDES Program Manager, with me. And we wanted to have a conversation, hopefully today, with the board about our stormwater design manual update. We've given some high-level presentations in here in the past when we started this project about what we're going to try and do. Given presentations to the Planning Commission, to our board, and other folks sort of at the beginning of the process along the way. I didn't really want to give the same presentation that you've already seen today, so I don't have a presentation.
Okay.
And what I wanted to do is take a few minutes up front just to sort of talk about the process, talk about the new permit and what we have to do, sort of at a high level, get into some of the details of what I think are the most significant parts, and I think that's a good opportunity for discussion for folks. I will mention we've been at this for about 15 months now, and we have a technical advisory committee as well as a stakeholder advisory committee that have been helping us through the process. Several members of the DEEB are on one of those committees, and Eric and Andrew are both on the TAC and JD participates in our stakeholders group as well. So they know a lot about what we've been doing, and I hope will be part of the discussion as well. And I just wanted to start with a comment that, or to sort of echo a comment that actually Bob made at the last DEEP meeting, and I was here where I was sitting in, and we were talking about having a presentation about our stormwater design manual, and Op said something along the lines of, really using this board's time to focus on the things that we really can change or that we can influence, and not really spending a lot of time talking about the things that we can't change. And I think that's just sort of a good overarching reminder. Our task in looking at our design manual was basically to incorporate the Department of Ecology's minimum requirements and our municipal stormwater permit into our design manual. Our design manual needs to be equivalent with the state's manual. In other words, we need to have things like the same thresholds for impervious area for projects in our code and design manual as they have, the same approved EMPs to be used for managing on-site stormwater treatment, flow control, et cetera, as well as the same design standards. Those are the areas we don't have a lot of flexibility. Our manual needs to be equivalent with theirs. And looking at what we had to do to our existing design manual to make it equivalent, we decided we couldn't just update our design manual. We wanted to write an entirely new design manual. And a big part of that would be as we start to add stuff to a framework that wasn't really intended to have as much complication with on-site stormwater management, we didn't think it would be very usable. We had a concern about that. And we wanted to make sure that applicants who were trying to get through the engineering review process had a relatively easy or easier path to follow. So we created an entirely new manual in the last 15 months. That manual is out right now for public comment. It has been for about a month, maybe 3 weeks. The comment period ends next week. I want to touch on timeline real quick.
Sorry to interrupt you. How have you received any comments?
Yeah, we've received some, but not a lot.
Okay. Is that because your hands are essentially tied as far as, kind of like our review of this, is you don't have a lot of flexibility to make changes that somebody might suggest?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the people that aren't commenting. I think there'll be a late push at the end that people will, do the homework at the last minute.
Right.
But I also, in touching on the timeline, I want to reiterate, this process started over a year ago. We have this review draft that's out for public comment. We need to finalize this draft design manual by around mid-June next month in order for us to submit it to the state for our equivalency determination. So our goal is to get a manual that we know is equivalent with the state's manual up front, incorporate as much public comment as we can into that manual. We've had, I think Jane told me the other day, over 70 meetings internally with staff in public works, community development, within our department to try and fine-tune the things that we're trying to do, as well as the advisory committees we've had. After we submit it, the state will give us a determination how close did we come to an equivalent manual, highlight the areas of concern, and then we have until July 1, 2015 to adopt it and make it effective. So I don't want folks to think that this is the only public comment period we're going to have. It's clearly not. It's the public comment period on the review draft. I expect that we will continue to make changes throughout the next year to affect the areas that we can affect. If we end up proposing some things within the next year that may influence the equivalency, we need to go back to the table with ecology and make sure that they're cool with those changes, whatever they may be, sometime over the next year. And if they're not, they basically will tell us, just like they did last time. They said, well, the change you just made, we're not going to approve, that same sort of thing. So we have to deal with that. But there's more opportunity to comment and fine-tune going forward, particularly on the process. Once we get, that's the manual, this is the permit, there are our twin towers, but once we get the design manual sort of laid out, I think we have a lot of work to do on how to insert that design manual into our engineering review process and just the overall application review process, trying to make it as easy as possible. And then training. We have to get out there and talk to folks that are going to be using the manual on how they need to use it, what they need to submit, how it might influence their projects. And a lot of training internally to make sure people know how to review the projects that they're getting against the manual. That's a huge task for us. But the main, you know, main milestone that we need to get over is submittal to the state. Overall, in the permit, those in terms of the minimum requirements that apply to development projects, there are 9 minimum requirements that we need to have equivalent requirements in our manual to the state's manual. The majority of those aren't changing. There are minor changes to 8 of the 9 requirements. The most significant change is to minimum requirement number 5, which is on-site stormwater management. And that is the low impact development mandate. And that, while it only changes 1 minimum requirement, changes everything. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And from this part forward, you know, just kind of highlighting what some of those changes will be for context. You know, if you guys want to jump in with questions, I would hope this would be a discussion at this point. So on-site stormwater management, as I said, is basically the mandate to use the low-impact development BMPs to the extent feasible on your project. The thresholds that the minimum requirements apply to for project size are very small, a couple thousand feet of new impervious area, and you're thinking about these requirements. So they apply to pretty much every development project. And then those BMPs need to be used to the extent feasible to infiltrate, disperse, and retain runoff on your site. It sounds relatively simple. It's not, as you know. There are a couple ways that Ecology has laid out in their manual that we've incorporated into ours to do this, depending on whether you have what we call a small project where only minimum requirements 1 through 5, and 5 being the on-site stormwater management requirement. Smaller projects can choose BMPs. Well, both small and large projects, you can choose BMPs like rain gardens or permeable pavement or dispersion or whatever from a list, or you can demonstrate compliance with the new performance standard that needs to be modeled that Ecology has created. So people have a choice. Clearly the larger projects are probably going to use the performance standard because they have people that can do that. We have to be mindful of the smaller projects that people don't necessarily have an engineer or someone to run the Western Washington hydrology model to see if they're complying with that on-site stormwater management performance standard. But there are options in the list. One of the, I think, challenges in just choosing BMPs from the list is that Department of Ecology decided which BMPs people need to use in a particular order.
So here comes my first question.
I have a second. Sorry, go ahead.
One, in relation to the lawsuit that you lost and won. What is Ecology telling you guys as far as their modification to the permit to address the where it's going to be appropriate to use permeable pavement, where it's not? How are you guys then overriding that into your specific manual?
Yeah, let me answer the last part first. Yeah. And that is, we're probably not going to incorporate any changes that Ecology makes to the feasibility requirements for permeable pavement for this draft. And that's purely based on timing. Rod and I have both been working with our permit manager as well as Bill Moore to say, you know, you guys need to get us guidance on how you're going to make changes to the manual and or the permit, or both. I think they have to change both. And they say, yeah, we'll get that to you, you know, probably in time for your draft submittal. I've let them know if I don't get that by the middle of May, then it's not going to go into the manual. So they have a timing issue they kind of need to work out. We can always change it later. You know, again, if they say it's equivalent, then they change the feasibility requirements or the feasibility criteria for permeable pavement, we will adjust accordingly down the road. I don't know I don't know what they're going to do at this point. Basically, in a nutshell, the PCHB said they sort of limited some of the application of the use of permeable pavement. One of the things they said was it's only feasible for very low traffic volume roads.
And it said very.
Very low traffic volume roads.
The word means very.
Yeah, so what does that mean? And the question is ecology going to say what a very low traffic volume road is, or are they going to leave that up to us to say what a very low traffic volume road is, and we'll need to work that out?
You don't know that?
Yeah. No. And people, I'm sure people have some opinions. But there's a range of opinions from the other permittees that we've talked to. And one of them that we talked to said they've already defined it. They're going to say it's 480T. But others say, where do you get that?
ASHTO has a manual called Design of Very Low Volume Roadways. Not that that's the definition they meant, but you know, there's some guidance there based on, you know, what the transportation industry considers very low volume roadways. So maybe it's a place to start.
I don't know whether ecology will engage their sister department in the Department of Transportation to work that out, or whether they'll just purely let people define it. They may just let us define it, and then we will find something that we can support, you know, some standard in defining. But basically, it does limit the application of permeable pavement. To get back to the list, though, Jamie, in your question, you know, on a small project, when you got to go through the order, if you're building a, like an example would be single-family residential triggering minimum requirements 1 through 5. You got to choose from the list of feasible BMPs. You start. Everyone has to do soil quality and depth for all landscaped areas. Then for roof runoff, you have to go dispersion or full infiltration, rain gardens. Rain gardens, downspout dispersion or perforated stub outs, and then on dry, basically other impermeable surfaces. Those would be driveways, patios, things like that for single-family residential, full dispersion, and then permeable pavement or rain gardens. They're of equal weight or sheet flow or concentrated dispersion. But you basically got to go through and say, hey, I need to check this one. Is it feasible or not? If it's not, I don't need to use it. I can go to the next one. I can go to the next one.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Who and how is feasibility determined in that case?
Good question. I'll skip ahead.
Very good question.
You thought that when we leave that up to you.
Yeah, you decide.
We win.
Let me make one other example, and just a slight difference in the list, and then I'll get into that. For larger projects that trigger all the minimum requirements, you have a choice to use the performance standard, or you can choose from a list, but it's a different list than small projects. And the main difference in that list is that permeable pavement has a priority over bioretention. I don't understand it. I can't say why it is, but you need to check off the permeable pavement feasibility before you can go to rain gardens. Personally, I think that's a mistake.
Yeah.
Agreed. But it is what it is. It's in the list. Okay. So there are essentially infeasibility tests in the design manual, basically yes or no questions that you go through for specific on-site stormwater management BMPs. It's not for all treatment and flow control BMPs. It's for things like rain gardens, dispersion, permeable pavement. And the lists are longer in some of the BMPs than the other one. Basically, if you can answer yes to the question, you can determine that BMP is infeasible and you don't have to do it.
Essentially like a flow chart. Yes. If this, no, yes, and at the end, you check it off.
Yeah. You know, if you're using the performance standard and you're modeling it, you don't necessarily need to use any BMPs in any particular order. You can try and just sprinkle them into your project and try and meet the performance standard, but if you're going down the list, you got to look and say, if you're doing a large project, minimum requirement 1 through 9, you're going to get to permeable pavement. You got to determine whether permeable pavement is feasible or infeasible, depending on the questions in that list. And it's a pretty long list for permeable pavement. It's things like, you know, high groundwater, traffic volumes, slopes for permeable pavement, things like that. And you go through the list, and if you can't determine that it's infeasible, then you have to use that BMP in your project. That's how the process will work.
Okay, my second question. I'm tipping out where I'm going to make my comments. The PCHB decision did not preclude the possibility for the county to propose to ecology additional feasibility criteria, including economics. Is staff supporting that, or are you just sort of laying control on that and making a comment?
I'll note that there are no economic infeasibility criteria currently. Right. We're not working on any economic infeasibility criteria right now. I anticipate that we will get comments that we should propose or look at infeasibility criteria from an economic standpoint. One of the challenges for us in terms of change of adding infeasibility requirements is where we have to provide a justification, so we have to have a pretty defensible, not only for us but for ecology, to approve it. And I don't know what those would be from an economic standpoint at this point. I would hope that if people make some comments that we should have economic infeasibility criteria, that they give us some ideas.
So county adopts this in the ecology agreement. From an implementation side of things, is county then given authority to basically call on these items and discretion? And I know it's still the NPDES process, and they have to say, call to come back in and commit the stage.
No.
So this is a manual level.
Yeah.
Sets the stage, and then the county basically wants the program.
Yes. And it's up to, you know, I think there's the ball's in the applicant's court to determine feasibility or infeasibility in their application. The county's role is going to be at some level going through and checking, but at what level remains to be seen. Some of the infeasibility criteria are very, very vague, which can be good. I mean, it might allow some flexibility, or it could be more challenging. I know some of the other permittees are working on clarifying and being more specific on infeasibility criteria, but we haven't done that. There's one, for example, I'm paraphrasing roughly, in bioretention, that bioretention is infeasible if you don't have enough available space on your site. I mean, I don't know what, you know, if someone comes to us with an application and says, I looked at bioretention, but I don't have enough room, what are we going to say? You know, we need to figure that out. But they don't. They will only have a role in saying we have to show the manual. If we follow that manual, then we're good to go. It's important to note that two of the other minimum requirements, 6 and 7, which are treatment and flow control for removing pollutants and for managing higher flows, those don't go away. Minimum requirement number 5, the on-site stormwater management, is added to that. So after you do the on-site stormwater management, if you're still generating runoff, that needs to be controlled and treated as well. So we will expect to, in some cases, you know, still see those features as well. People need to keep that in mind. Overall, in my opinion, minimum requirement number 5 is the overall effect is essentially to disincentivize site clearing in impervious areas. So if it's a business as usual approach, and particularly in challenging sites to develop where you have bad soils, high groundwater, and things like that, if it's go in, clear the site, and put down a lot of impervious area, it's going to be hard. It's going to be harder, and it's going to be more expensive. And I think that's the intent. So sort of planning, that makes sort of planning your site up front, planning your project even that much more important. Even selecting your site even makes it that much more important as well.
Question 3.
Should I be writing them down? I'm always writing them down.
No, there'll be comments.
To be followed up. No, I know that there was some concern with how the permit was drafted, that they required the
developers to only do testing in different ones. And so if you're a property owner and you end up purchasing, say, in spring and summer, you're basically held in abeyance until...
Are you talking about groundwater testing?
Yeah. 9 months down the road before you can do that and you get an application. And so I'm just thinking of it from, you know, the development community's perspective and trying to especially address challenging sites. How do we sort of harmonize that more practical versus just permit?
Yeah.
Staff are any solutions?
We are spending time talking about the context of this manual and the entire development review process, trying to make as much of these considerations, sort of front-loading the review process for the applicant and for us. So I will say, yes, we're working on some process issues. From an infiltration testing and a groundwater or water table elevation standpoint, but I can't emphasize enough how important it is to have that information in your design. And I know that it's challenging from a timing standpoint. If we really need to know what the high water table elevation is, and the testing time is 9 months away from, you know, it's kind of unfortunate, but. We've seen enough failed infiltration facilities around here that we're spending a lot of money on now that, I mean, I think it's our responsibility to make sure they're going to work. I think we'll see less of that, for the most part, with some of these decentralized approaches, because when you take all the runoff from a subdivision or a multifamily or commercial project and run it all to one spot and try and squeeze it into the ground, everything sort of needs to line up right. I'm not saying I don't anticipate any problems with the more dispersed system, but it's less of an issue. I don't actually know what the testing requirements are for all these individual dispersed sites, whether you guys probably know that in terms of testing for the high groundwater or the water table elevation, it needs to be done for a rain garden as well, or if that's just more for a larger infiltration system. Do you know?
You need to know how much vertical separation you have from the water retention.
So that's one of the infeasibility criteria. Do you have enough separation to do the bioretention? If you don't, you don't have to do bioretention. But how do we, you know, what data do you use for that? I don't think, Jamie, we've come up with a solution to the timing for infiltration testing yet. Well, what's a reasonable risk for us?
Is there a way to mitigate the risk to the county by harnessing some of the historical data in the area? I mean, there are certain areas of the county that you don't have historical problems with high groundwater or permeability. And you know, it seems a bit ridiculous to make a developer wait 6 to 9 months to do their infiltration testing from the time they decide to study that piece of property, when you've got 50 years worth of development that's been happening out there in those areas, and you should have some pretty good information. I know at the district we've got a full bookcase full of old geotech reports and stuff like that, because anytime we're doing projects in that area, we want to know whether we're going to be having to do a lot of dewatering or whether we're going to have problems with water migration in the trench or something like that. So we have a library full of that kind of information that we use to determine how we're going to pull a project. It's kind of a color of that information getting around somewhere.
We are somewhat limited by the infiltration testing requirements for the testing requirements for infiltration facilities by the college's manual, what we have to have in ours. At the same time, I think, Steve, in terms of the practical implementation of our code, and Ali would know better than others, we have some provisions that if people can provide reasonably close geotechnical reports or other information, or even our groundwater elevation mapping that shows,
do we have a number that we look on? Maybe like it's less than 20 or 25 of that thing?
15 feet below the bottom of the 14 feet.
Right, but in terms of like the groundwater elevation maps, do we
see they have 10 feet?
Because
I'm estimating that the subcommittee is going to take subcommittee recommendation of 25
from the maps.
From that study. So we have the groundwater elevation maps, and I think Steve get along with something that if there's other supporting information in the groundwater elevation map shows that it's 25 to 30 feet in that spot, then you can do testing in a different time period. But if it's less than that, you need to know what it is.
I would think you'd be able to write something, I would say, unless there's surface indication like water. Something to that effect, because they're a local, I mean, you're not going to be able to pinpoint that one site with information from other sites, but you can make some pretty good educated guesses and at least not hold somebody up who's invested some money in trying to put a site together.
Sure. Yeah, and especially, as I said before, we have a fairly long list of failed infiltration facilities that people were adamant about their performance and that they were going to work, and they don't. But at the same time, if we have people who if we have information, if we have stamped plans, if we have a geotech report, there's opportunity for some flexibility. I think the ball's in our court on that one. I don't think the state's going to give this too much credit.
Good idea. I just want to be on that in general. Thank you for the flexibility. Time is the enemy of any project. And if you've got a little thing like groundwater testing, possibly hold there for 6 months, I think we're going to find out whether or not they're feeding.
Yeah.
So I know you're headed this direction, but if you could provide some flexibility somehow, okay. You can't give us the per letter, but here's some other options for you that would allow you to proceed. That would be valuable for economic development in general.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one thing.
Yep.
Is there anything in this whole process that affected or changed the best? Either moving forward or backward?
Yeah, so this lets me know that I laid my presentation out well, because that's my next thing. I was going to the question about, what about current projects? And again, sort of touching on investing. Again, what the permit says is that these new rules, when we adopt them and they're effective by July 1, 2015, it applies to all applications submitted after July 1, 2015.
Applications.
Not final engineering.
Yeah. Like, so it did uphold that.
I would think so, technically. Complete applications.
I think that's up to us to define ecology.
I think that would be a good way to define.
Ecology, when they said applications, put in a little footnote. On what applications mean, it's in ecology's mind what an application looks like, which isn't anything tangible to the real world, but if you have the site, you have roughly what you're going to do, stuff like that. If I can find the footnote, I'll read it to you. But it is application, not final engineering or anything like that.
And then the next question, the follow-up question would be, how will contingent vesting at the time of pre-app work for the same?
Well, we have to figure that out.
I think that's something that this board would be very interested in knowing what the county's approach is going to be, and how they're going to adjust.
I think that's the application.
You think that's happening?
What I've heard is, I had a discussion with Bill Moore about this, and his question back to me is if it's a pre-application item, how can it be an application? And we'll just have to deal with that. Well, it's a pre-application, is it an application?
The county code has two different versions of it. Right. So you can go for a pre-app, or you can go for a pre-app requesting contingent vesting. If you go for requesting contingent vesting, you have to do more work.
Yeah.
So you need to have preliminary stormwater, you need to have it signed by a PD, and it has to be looked at. I would propose to continue with the same classification.
I agree.
Okay.
So if it means contingent vesting.
I don't know if we have any language on that right now in our code and manual, or if that's more of a process question down the road.
Other manuals, yeah. It's in my other codes. But
just to We're doing great.
Yep.
The application means, this is from the permit, application means at a minimum a complete project description, site plan, and if applicable, CEQA checklist. So we have to abide by that.
If applicable.
Ron, is the site plan the stormwater site plan, because there is a difference?
Yeah.
The way they look at it, it's not a plan.
Right. Well, minimum requirement number one is to have a stormwater site plan, so at least preliminary one. But, you know, I think that's a good discussion for us to have about what application means. So any applications received, it applies. The new requirements apply to projects, what they say, have not started construction. So shall apply to projects approved prior to July 1, 2015, which have not started construction by June 30, 2020, when they define what started construction means. I think that is also for things that, it's not only for things that have received approval, but for applications as well. So if you submitted your application before July 1, 2015, or even if you have final engineering, you know, those that are in the pipeline, you have until 2020. I think, Eric, your impression was that was close to vesting?
Yeah.
For the current vesting?
Yeah, there's actually
provisions,
determinations in the preliminary that referenced other code areas in the state vesting sector, and they attempted to match that. Now, what it doesn't say is when the state legislature extended, how that affects those timelines. Because if our manual says a certain date, and it's not cross-referencing those same statutes, if the intent is to increase those vesting statutes, then it should apply to everything. Because if you're vesting a development and you're not vesting stormwater, it's not the same developer.
Right. Yeah, not the same.
So the intent that the state had when they extended it, Mr. Benton probably knows better than any of us since he was there, but it was extending everything. It wasn't just pieces of it.
Right.
There was a specific restriction to shorelines in the last one, and that was specifically addressed shoreline exemptions. But otherwise, it applies to everything else.
I think that's why when we talk about impacts to vesting and whether vesting is upheld, my answer is it's somewhere in the middle. Because they give applications for approvals in the pipeline 5 years from when all the rest of this is going to be due. That may not be as long as other projects where you're vesting to other regulations, but I think it would be hard for us to allow any projects in the pipeline that go beyond 2020 to not have to follow this. I think that would put us in a fairly weak position. And it doesn't really jive with the state's vesting. But that's what
I think the problem is going to come. Other than the appeals going on this issue, what happens with phase projects?
Extend
beyond the 5-year deadline. And I'm knowing this intimately now with condominiums, for instance. You know, the way the statute works is you have a period of 7 years, for instance, to try to add new phases into a project. And so clearly, if you started, let's say you got the approval for next year and you started, and yet you were adding another phase to that condo. 2023,
you're still within your time frame to do that, then would you be required to get it? I don't know. I think that's a problem. If I'm not mistaken, Eric, you probably know better than I do, but I got a project right now that the phases allow extensions as long as you proceed in within these certain time frames that you are allowed.
And I think that works for planning, but I've got the same concern on like a shopping center or a university, and you've got massive pavement areas, and so if you don't want to do a new development, is it just for that area that's new, or is it the whole wider area?
Yeah, do you have to build out the entire storm system for the entire development with the first phase just to make sure that you don't get stuck down the road having to do more, or if you plan on having individual stormwater systems for each phase? And that's where the difficulty comes. And the questions about whether or not vesting would be maintained as you're working through those phases, should they go beyond 2020, or something that was approved prior to 2015.
Right.
would it even work to build it all out? Because if your construction is moving on past 2020, do you have to now meet a different stormwater with a phase that fills out after 2020?
That's
yeah. So you build your entire stormwater system for the whole project and then find out you've got eight.
And I think what they've said now, though, is that if you do build the whole thing out for everything, that you're good.
But you're not building out all your
impervious. But you're not building out all your impervious. You're not building out your buildings. You're not doing all your stuff. But that's a huge upfront cost.
The way I hear that, you're not actually vested for what you are. The stormwater system isn't complete until you have all the impervious surface. So
that's
if you're
true.
Building any impervious after
Nelson, yeah.
2020, you're having to be a new standard.
Yeah.
The specific permit language, and again, I think we do absolutely need to clarify it, but when it comes to construction, it says that you've not started construction by June 30, 2020.
Tech started construction on a particular phase?
Right. So it's,
yeah. I mean, project that encompassed the whole, you mean one phase encompassed the whole project?
We can
just stay silent on that. I think we're asking these questions.
Yeah, I mean, these are kind of some
big questions.
They're challenging questions for ecology because, and again, this is just a reality check of I'm not being overly critical. They don't understand process. Maybe some of those questions you might not want to ask. But I think we do have some flexibility to say, if somebody submits an application and then that application is in the pipeline for approval and construction has started on a five-phase residential subdivision, I don't interpret this to say that you need to start construction on every individual phase. I think it kind of has to do with the application and the approval. I think that's how I read it. Now, I don't know whether kind of go both ways, but whether you lay out a five-phase subdivision and you go get individual approvals for every individual phase, or whether you kind of do one and then do some post-decision stuff afterwards as things change, I think that's probably still an application that came in. That's how I interpret it. I'm trying to think of where we can clarify it, but
I think we'd be interested in knowing where the county's going to land with all of this.
Yeah.
I think we could also provide some guidance.
Sure. I think we already have.
Good.
The only other wrinkle I like to add wrinkles is on the, because there are development agreements that are out there as well, it also can theoretically extend permit. Washington State Vancouver is an excellent example.
It's challenging on that front though, because for storm drainage, it's a little bit. I mean, they've been through four storm drainage ordinances in the county. They've been in that long. This is going to be a fifth. So, and it's challenging each time because each ordinance is different. But some of those are productive systems, and so it's a huge question. Millions of dollars in pavement and infrastructure. And I know you guys are trying to make that work in this confine. It's not to make that point that out, but those are huge questions. Or let's say Fred Meyer. Let's say they have a Kevin built a facility out of Sand Creek. It looks like it's pretty well built. What if there's a shopping center pad or somebody gets out and add it on? And that happens a lot in these complexes. And how do people deal with that?
And I think that something like a Washington State University that say it has a 20-year build-out plan is a good example, a relatively safe example to put forward and say, how does this apply to something like that? Is it reasonable to have a 20-year plan and say that you're locked into those stormwater regulations at that time for a parking lot and a building you're going to build 20 years from now? I don't know. I mean, we could get some clarification from ecology on how this applies to a project like that. I don't think that having to come in and, while it will change what you have to do, WSU said, we need to have a big building and a parking lot of this area down here, which we don't even have a road to at this point. And you have to come in, and if you have to come in under this, it's not going to keep you from doing the project. It may change a little bit what you were going to do. It may change the cost. But you'd probably be expecting a different cost anyway 20 years down the road. But that's a good example.
I think, for whatever they're planning to do, COVID new, I know new is a word mark because it gets defined in each ordinance differently, but that new word is critical. It could be everything or it could be just what is being developed, but when it's integrated, I think it's fair for whatever is starting to be new. But if you're going back in time, it might end up causing a moratorium. different sorts for the elements.
Okay. We'll go ahead and let you finish up. We're about at your time limit, so if you've got any more to do, go ahead.
I don't. I just wanted to, you know, jump back on a couple reminders again. We have the end of comment period coming up, but, you know, I think we're open to more comments. Our biggest issue with receiving comments is getting them into that manual by the middle of June, and working with our contractor who's preparing it for us within their scope of work when they have to put pencils down. So it's mainly just a logistical issue of getting the drafts in the middle. Also that we have a work session scheduled with the board on May 14th. I don't have the time. I don't know if it's on what Greg has.
I think it is.
But that's going to be our opportunity to loop back and have a similar sort of high-level discussion with the board on where we are in the project, how we think we're doing in terms of complying with the permit, because that is a huge priority for us. And then, you know, some of the substantive changes that they see going forward. So if you're interested in that conversation with them, come to the work session on the 14th.
Real quick, in the past, once there's been a draft that's been out there, and it comes kind of to this board, we make a formal recommendation to the board for the hearing. Is that outside of the public process or the public comment period? This is a little different than like a public comment. It's a group, and we want to kind of analyze the comments that come in and the draft. So do we have, can we have a timeline for when you need stuff from this board so that we can provide comments? Can it be our next meeting? I guess we need our guidance, and hopefully it's not Monday. But
I don't think it's Monday.
Okay.
So for this one, and that's a good point, I mean, we're going to have a work session with the board. We're not going to have a hearing on this draft submittal. We're just going to submit it to the college. And down the road, after they give us this their first take on our equivalency for the next year until 2015, there will be multiple opportunities, more comment periods, as well as a public hearing. But that's not going to be part of the process for this draft submittal.
Shouldn't the board look at it before? Because once you give something to a college, it's really hard to take it back. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, just from working with them in the past, it's almost impossible to go backwards.
At the work session, we're going to present what we have, and we're going to request the board's authorization to submit the draft. You know, it's not going to be a consent item, it's not going to be a public hearing. I don't think, Eric, it'll be that tough to take things that don't matter for equivalency to propose some changes. If we're adding feasibility requirements, they're clearly going to need to look at that. And our best effort will be to engage ecology along the way, and so that they know if we're proposing new feasibility requirements or things that do influence equivalency and aren't just process, then they know they'll be giving us the nod before we submit them for the second time.
Ron, have you looked at WashDOT's feasibility checklist? I can send it to you or to Drew. It's extremely thorough. It's been approved by ecology, and it may be the best avenue to get the best of both worlds in presenting something to ecology, although it doesn't fit in the timeline.
Yeah, it won't fit in the timeline, Sean, for this draft submittal. It kind of goes back to what Eric was talking about. This is a conversation that we had with ecology, because when I was talking to them, for us being the smallest phase one permittee and not necessarily having the resources that others are putting into this effort, I want to have the opportunity to look at Pierce County's manual and Snohomish County's manual and WashDOT's manual and steal portions of their manual that are better ideas than we have. And they recognize that. They recognize that we'll make those changes. We've incorporated some elements of ecology's BMP selection process. I mean, not ecology's, WashDOT's BMP selection process, and in our draft manual have some notes to reviewers in there. If people read those sections, there's a note to reviewers saying we're looking for feedback on whether or not we should try and incorporate DOT's entire BMP selection process. I'd say right now we're somewhere in the middle. We're somewhere in the middle of ecology's manual and WashDOT process, recognizing that it's something we can use. There's some limits to what we can use that process, that BMP selection process for, but we're working on it. I'll just say that. both Snohomish and King County have indicated they're looking at it as well and probably won't get into their draft manuals. But it's a little bit more of a whole menu approach to selecting BMPs that gets you to where ecology wants to get you.
Go ahead, Ron.
Just a thought that popped up from Sean's comment. If we had a note in the infeasibility criteria that the county will review or consider criteria or infeasibility criteria allowed in any other manuals found to be equivalent by DOE, if we had a little note like that in there, it's giving you guys flexibility to, as someone else comes up with something different, if they approve it or watch that, it's good enough for them, it should be good enough for us here in Clark County too. So having a note like that, and maybe on a case-by-case, because there's different things, but including something like that, a line like that, gives us great flexibility. And I don't see how DOE could say, hey, we're not going to allow that. So, yeah, it's good for them, it's good for everybody. So just a thought, and I'll try to put that in writing before.
Yeah, that would be good.
Thank you, Ron. I just kind of want to wrap this up. Just for the groups and on this, it sounds to me like we're going to need, I mean, it would be prudent to have some comments back to them that they can incorporate in there, or at least start thinking about. They heard quite a bit from us today. And hopefully they'll start thinking about some of that stuff, mainly items such as vesting definitions as far as what vesting is and what applications are, phasing issues, things like that. When the best time would be to do that. And I'm going to maybe kind of lean on you two, knowing a little bit more about this process than the rest of us, when it might be best for us to provide a, or whether we need to provide a formal comments to the county on this, to staff on this, or whether or not they've heard enough about it. I mean, that's kind of a question, I guess, to everybody else. They've heard what the concerns are, or if we want to put something a little more formal together and be a party of record.
Yeah, I guess looking at the upcoming events, public comment closes Monday, 5 o'clock.
They said they still accept.
They still accept comments, okay. There's a TAC meeting on the 7th, correct?
Yep.
There's a board meeting on, or board work session on the 14th. So from what I'm seeing, we need to get something from this board before probably the 14th, and that's still not a lot of time. That's
what,
2 weeks.
What I would suggest is, I know I haven't submitted comments. Assuming that you're going to comment, or Andrew, are you
going to
comment?
Trying.
Steve, are you guys
going to
comment?
Robin's been dealing with.
Okay, so maybe like Monday we could powwow out an email, share what our, for those of us who can submit a comment, can share that with the group, and then we could cobble something together for them then, or for Mike, for this body.
That'd be great.
It's a little different when you're on this. Being on the TAC, we've been submitting comments for months now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like this is the first time I've seen it, but what I want to do, and I've kind of had it on my list, unfortunately we get busy doing other jobs as well, but I'd like to look at some of the stuff in the discussions and just compare it to where we ended up, because I've got lots of discussion and notes and stuff in my materials, and I got some time allocated Sunday and Monday. Try to do that to get it to you guys, but it might not be in like a very a list. I just want to see what was incorporated, what wasn't. Maybe even sit down with you sometime before the 7th or the 14th.
And it might be something to where we don't necessarily put forth any potential solutions, but certainly identify the concerns that we have the most as a board. Mm-hmm. I mean, your guys' stuff might be more technical. You might be from more of a legal standpoint. From our standpoint, from the development standpoint, we certainly have some we have bookends on that, and that's maybe what we want to maybe have you guys put together. And even if you were to provide that to us or to, Greg and I, and we can get together and then put together something formal for Deep to submit, send it around and around for comment, and then, be a party of record as far as this is concerned. Does that make sense?
That's what I would suggest. If you can gather up whoever submits comments, and then you can decide, Jamie, you're being too legal, that's not a deep issue.
Right.
We like what you're saying here, or Eric, this is too technical, that we like what you're saying
exactly.
Here.
If there's
like seven bullet points with a sentence behind, a sentence or two behind each bullet point.
An explanation.
I'm totally supportive of that. I know there's a lot of...
That's all I'm thinking.
And that's great, but I think sometimes that takes its own like course, but it's like, here are the seven items that we're concerned with. Here's a sentence behind each one of those. And I like the legal part's really important to you, and I'm not just counting it.
Okay.
Just think that's...
So when do you when do you need that from us? I guess it's kind of back to the original question.
Yeah,
when do you need our...
you know, every time, I mean, it's commenting in the window, you know, it's the sort of party record where we will lay out all those comments and respond to all the comments. Every other comments, we're keeping everyone's comments in the log. We're responding, I think, to everything. Again, it's more just us logistically using our contractor and the staff that we have to get comments into this draft. And so I would think, you know, ideally, I mean, by the end of next week, I'm sure we can still accommodate our contractors.
Can you guys do that?
Yeah.
Ahead next week?
And we would still, if you get it to us now, we can fold it into this draft, you know, but the ones that come in later, they still don't go away. They just, we just don't have the ability to get them into this draft.
Okay, I think one way or the other. Okay, great. Thank you. You guys did a great job. Thank you.
Thanks for
the weekend. The last thing that we had that we kind of passed over at the beginning of the meeting was our work plan in our 2014 and 2015 priority. We had 2015-16. This is usually kind of a biennium that we base these on. We've got a long list of stuff that we've talked about. The only person that I've really heard from is Ott. I think we left the last meeting to where, hey, send me your priorities. I'll compile them together. This will be part of the discussion that we're going to have with the board next month. Right now, we're looking at a 60-day review process, and I know that I think Marty needs to kind of get a shareholders meeting together to find out how that's gone and what the issues are to tweak things accordingly. There's some talk about consolidation of permits. I'm not exactly sure where we're at with that. Stormwater, I mean, that's one of the tops of the list there, and I think that was a great presentation they gave today. The plat alteration process, final site plan, concurrency, another great presentation today. Updates on the fee holiday. We've got the fall biannuals coming up, and I would encourage everyone, if you have anything that you want to incorporate in there, get in sooner than later. Fees, Eric's, I would hope that
grading
you
fees.
Want to, what's that?
The grading.
Grading or the control fees. And inspection fees.
That's one.
The lien process, see how it's going, seeing if they're falling backwards or if they can keep going forward with that process. Staffing levels is going to be real important, I think, coming up. In fact, I think we're already starting to see that now that Jardine's doing not only concurrency but also development engineering review. Permit center wait times. I've personal experience with that. You know, again, and we don't have Mike Bomar here, but he was kind of spearheading the technological aspects of where the county can go as far as Skyping inspections. Wherever we can, kind of parenthetically with that would be the permit center upgrades, which they've punted and are starting from scratch. So go through it. I think you have that document that was provided at the last meeting. Please go through that within the next week or two. Send me your priorities and thoughts. I need to get something together, probably with Helen, to get the presentation for BOCC put together. But I want to know what our priorities are, and we haven't had time to discuss them as a group. But I think that if we can get them together, we can go ahead and take care of it, because our meeting with the board happens the day before our next meeting, and so we're going to have to do this all via email. And I think we're all on the same page as far as most of these are concerned. But if anybody has anything specific, anything new, or wants to elaborate on any of these, particularly with your thoughts, that's what we really want to hear.
You did a great job of covering them. Those are kind of what we talked about last time. I provided some comments before that one. I think I provided some comments after that.
Right.
I like the priorities.
And my apologies. I did hear from you before. I heard from Mike. So I'll take those. We'll compile them. We'll get them together. I'll work with Helen on getting the last year's review put together, and we might, you know, tag team this, and that she presents for last year. I'll present what we're planning on doing this year, and if anything else comes up, we'll just attack it as they do. Any other comments? I see there's no one left from the public here, so we don't have any public. Any other comments from anybody else? Other than that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot.
I think so.
Sorry about that. We were going to invite Oliver to come back.
They got to get on that. I've been harping on that. They got to help me come back in February. Sure. Oliver, man, not there for the March. April, May, really?
We'll get him out of here for sure.
Or that final.